Welcome to the Audio Digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Michael Roy, Executive Editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry, with highlights for our February 2018 issue. We'll look at new research on bright light therapy for bipolar depression, how well a single dose of ketamine reduced suicidal thoughts in patients with depression. Our review article in the issue, part of the journal's commemoration of our 175th year of publication, provides a roadmap for understanding the neurodevelopmental origins of conditions that manifest in early childhood. Our treatment and psychiatry report will evaluate prolonged symptoms following concussion. And at the end of the podcast, we'll be joined by Dr. Margaret Sibley, lead author of a study that examined the diagnosis of late-onset ADHD.
I think the big question that stems from this line of research is, what does this mean for our diagnostic system, and what kind of information should we be trying to put together for practitioners to guide them when they're making some of these difficult decisions?
We begin with bright lights, bipolar depression. Treatment for bipolar depression remains a challenge. To address this, Dorothy Sitt of Northwestern University conducted with colleagues a randomized, double-blind trial among depressed adults with bipolar 1 or bipolar 2 disorder to determine whether bright light therapy, in combination with antiemetic medication, could improve symptoms of depression in these patients. The authors randomly assigned patients to a 7,000 lux bright white light or to a dim red placebo light unit. They began with a 15-minute light session between noon and 2:30 p.m., which was increased weekly by 15 minutes to a target dose of 1 hour per day. The authors noted that midday treatment should have a subtle effect on circadian rhythms. This, along with a gradual increase in duration of light therapy, would be less likely to trigger manic symptoms. After 6 weeks, the authors found that the group treated with add-on midday bright light therapy had lower depression scores and a higher rate of remission, which meant that patients experienced minimal depression and were more likely to report normal functioning. In addition, the authors did not observe any changes to mood polarity. Patients also had improvement in global functioning and less excessive sleep. The time of day of light therapy is thought to be key to this treatment, and a longer treatment protocol may produce higher rates of remission. But the authors caution that more research is needed to further quantify just how light therapy works in this patient population. Next, a critical public health issue, suicide. Currently, treatment options for patients at acute risk for suicide are limited. Recent studies of ketamine have shown that the drug can produce rapid effects on suicidal thoughts and depression. So Samuel Wilkinson of Yale University conducted with colleagues a systematic review and meta-analysis of patient-level data to probe ketamine's anti-suicidal effects. The authors identified 10 clinical trials to include in their review, and these were published between 2000 and 2016. Only trials that used a comparison, such as saline or midazolam, to a single dose of intravenous ketamine were included. The meta-analysis found that ketamine significantly reduced suicidal ideation within 1 day in patients with depression. This effect was observed on both clinician-administered and patient self-reported outcome measures. The effect lasted for up to 1 week and remained significant after the authors controlled for the change in severity of depressive symptoms. This finding indicates that the effect ketamine has on suicidal ideation may depend only somewhat on the change in the overall severity of symptoms of depression. While these results indicate that ketamine is a promising and quick-acting intervention for patients at risk for suicide, the authors caution that more research is needed in patient populations with a range of mood and anxiety disorders. And they add that important questions about ketamine remain unanswered, such as its dosing frequency and long-term safety and efficacy. The review article in the February issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry is part of the journal's commemoration of its 175th year of publication. In case you missed it, tune in to our January podcast to hear a conversation with Dr. Robert Friedman, editor-in-chief of the journal, who talks about how the journal is celebrating this milestone. In our February issue, Lauren Wachschlag and colleagues mark the occasion by reviewing the neurodevelopmental basis of early childhood disruptive behavior. The term neurodevelopmental disorders can be broadly understood as delays or deviations in functioning that are based on delays or deviations in brain development. Thus, both disruptive physiology and impaired functioning are inherent. The authors highlight two prominent phenotypes, irritability and callous behavior. Irritability and callous behavior may be indications for personality disorders, conduct disorders, and even criminal behavior. Atypical behavior can be defined in terms of how often it occurs, how long it lasts, and whether it takes place in an appropriate context, or takes place out of the blue for no reason. In particular, a gradual decrease in fear processing has been shown to differentiate normal irritability from atypical patterns. Not all children who have these syndromes will progress to those outcomes. However, early interventions in childhood may disrupt any development to negative outcomes. Overall, this review provides a clear framework for understanding this field of research in the context of findings that may seem contradictory. Importantly, the authors highlight that signs of extreme irritability and callousness may not be part of normal development, but may indicate later developmental problems. This may have broad implications for public health. This month's Treatment in Psychiatry article looks at symptoms that last well after a concussion. David Quinn from the University of Mexico presents along with colleagues the case of a 50-year-old man who was evaluated for cognitive impairment, fatigue, and depression following a concussion 6 months earlier. He had no significant medical or psychiatric history until his car collided with another vehicle. He lost consciousness and was taken to the hospital. A CT scan revealed no abnormalities. His vital signs were normal, and he was discharged with a diagnosis of concussion. His head hurt terribly the next 2 days, and he slept a lot. The next week, he returned to work but was tired and couldn't concentrate. He ended up taking a month off and applied for medical leave. His primary care physician prescribed nortriptyline and sumatriptan. His energy and concentration was impaired for 3 months, and he could not return to work. He was also stressed out from the legal ramifications stemming from the accident. He worried about his finances and about losing his job. After 6 months, he saw a psychiatrist, who prescribed an MRI scan. The MRI indicated possible axonal shear injury, and the psychiatrist prescribed 5 milligrams of methylphenidate to be taken twice daily. He also was prescribed CBT. He immediately noticed improvement in energy level and attention, and by 1 year after the injury, he returned to work full-time. Reviewing this case, the authors note that in addition to depressed mood and irritability, symptoms after concussion can include imbalance, nausea, migraines, blurred vision, and difficulty focusing. Typically, normal structural findings are observed on head CT or brain MRI tests at the time of a mild traumatic brain injury. Some of the most disabling physical symptoms following concussion are headaches, migraines, and insomnia, which can aggravate cognitive and emotional symptoms. The causes of post-concussive symptoms vary widely, and it is important for clinicians to be aware of any contributors both before and after the injury. Although there are no widely accepted or broadly studied treatments for prolonged post-concussive symptoms, clinicians can feel confident in creating a biopsychosocial treatment plan that may include medication, psychosocial interventions, metabolic supplements, and physical therapies. Now we are joined by Dr. Margaret Sibley to talk about her article in the February issue titled Late Onset ADHD Reconsidered with Comprehensive Repeated Assessments Between Ages 10 and 25. Dr. Sibley is a clinical psychologist and researcher at Florida International University, where she is Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health. Her research focuses on executive functioning, motivation, and attention problems in adolescents and young adults. Dr. Sibley, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Michael.
So your article found that symptoms in individuals who seek treatment for late-onset ADHD may stem from other causes, such as substance abuse or a comorbid condition. Could you explain what this finding means for practitioners?
Sure. I think the biggest take-home here is that when you have a person who presents clinically with symptoms of inattention or impulsivity, maybe in young adulthood or adulthood, and you're trying to decide, how do I diagnose this person or how do I treat this person? The key is careful assessment to make sure that those symptoms are not due to a cause that might warrant a different treatment. For example, our paper found that one of the common reasons that somebody might seem like they have symptoms of inattention or executive function difficulties in adulthood could actually be that they're overusing marijuana or other drugs that could have cognitive side effects. It could also be that they're experiencing depression, which also has symptoms that can resemble ADHD when we talk about concentration difficulties, difficulties with motivation, difficulty getting through daily responsibilities. So those types of difficulties, drug use, depression, and there's other examples too, warrant different treatments than what we would typically prescribe for someone with ADHD. For ADHD, we might prescribe a stimulant medication or a cognitive behavioral therapy. But for somebody who's struggling with drug problems, you know, that might involve addiction treatment. Or for somebody with depression, it might involve helping them with an antidepressant. So there are implications for making the right choices for people that could come out of this work.
Right. And when this article was first published online, it did receive a lot of attention, including from the New York Times. Were you surprised at the amount of attention the article received when we published it?
I wasn't surprised because I think the public has a lot of questions about ADHD as a diagnosis. Its symptoms could be subjective, and sometimes its symptoms are nonspecific. So we know there's a lot of reasons that people could have difficulties with their cognition, with their executive functioning, with their concentration or motivation. And right now, our field's best answer for a person who presents with those difficulties is a diagnosis of ADHD. But sometimes, you know, we look at people who've received those diagnoses, and even as professionals, we know it doesn't fit perfectly, but we're just not sure what else to do. So I think people, both the public and practitioners, are hungry for answers about, you know, what is ADHD and where does it fit within our medical practice. You know, I think that there is this question of people who may seek a diagnosis for the benefits that could come along with a diagnosis, the most common one being a prescription of stimulant medication, which some people use for performance enhancement or even for things like potentially appetite suppression or weight loss or just to have a little bit more energy to get through the day. And there's also people who may seek a diagnosis for something like post-secondary educational accommodations if they're in college or if they're in law school. So the question for, I think, that practitioners often have is, how do I know who to give a diagnosis and a prescription to and who not to? And so, you know, this is another study that helps try to answer that question a little bit.
So what other aspects of your study are relevant for clinicians and other mental health professionals?
So one of the dilemmas that practitioners face is if you have an adult who's presenting with ADHD symptoms, what is a careful assessment? And obviously there are practical bounds to what somebody can do in certain settings to gather more information and how much time someone could spend with someone. I think this research suggests one of the most important things to do is to talk to somebody besides the participant or the patient to understand what the person was like in childhood, to get a second perspective on what the person's like in daily life. Because it's really hard for anyone to describe themselves sometimes, to be able to accurately discuss where their difficulties and strengths lie, and it really helps to have a second perspective on that. It also helps to make sure that you are asking questions about lifestyle, substance use, about other mental health problems, and then really to isolate the time when the symptoms started and try to figure out, is there anything about the person's life that was different before the symptoms came on versus after that may explain why the symptoms onsetted? Because that actually might have important implications for your approach to treatment.
Well, that's great. And what's the next for you in your research? How does this continue?
I think the big question that stems from this line of research is, what does this mean for our diagnostic system, and what kind of information should we be trying to put together for practitioners to guide them when they're making some of these difficult decisions? So pursuing some of those questions, I think, is important. One piece is that there's been a lot of talk about this, is there spontaneous onset of ADHD symptoms in adulthood? Our paper actually drew some attention to the period of adolescence as well. It does seem like there are symptoms of ADHD that can begin in adolescence and actually last a few years and then be gone by the time the person reaches age 18. So there's questions about, I think for practitioners, that's a very challenging diagnosis to make, whether or not we think that those are, that kind of non-chronic or state-like attentional difficulties that could be stemming from environmental changes or developmental maturational changes inside the body. If those symptoms are causing somebody difficulties, what do we call that? How do we classify that? Where do those difficulties come from? So we're interested in looking a little bit at that. And also at, you know, collaborating with people who have a stake in updating the DSM to understand if some of these findings mean that we may want to enhance our description of the E criteria of the DSM, which is looking at what the rule outs are and the exclusions are for diagnosis, to maybe make that more specific, to offer more guidance to practitioners. I think that would be another place where the field needs some additional help so that people can just feel like they have a better sense of what to do in those difficult diagnostic situations with ADHD in adolescents or in adults.
So a lot still to come. Thank you. It's very interesting. I appreciate you coming to talk to us, Dr. Sibley.
Thank you. It was nice to be on.
And this concludes our highlights of the February issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to ajp@psych.org. Next month, we'll examine the therapeutic potential of physical exercise in early psychosis, the relationship between age-related hearing loss and cognitive decline, cannabidiol for schizophrenia, the change from mild cognitive impairment to Alzheimer's dementia, and computer-assisted versus standard CBT. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.